We're in the 24th chapter tonight of the book of Isaiah. I announced the other day, I thought it was 23rd, it's the 24th. In chapters 13 through 23, Isaiah is announcing prophecies against the nations of that time. Some 10 or 11 nations are mentioned, or are dealt with, rather, in those 11 chapters. Now, that is taking up each one of the nations that Israel or Judah was related to at that time or in contact with. Now, in the 24th, 5th, 6th, and 7th chapters, you have a prophecy of a universal or world judgment. Now, these chapters are not dealing with Judah nor with Babylon, but dealing with the world and the condition of the world at that time, and setting forth the principle that all of worldliness, or that the principles of the world that men follow, are going to be brought to naught. Now, the prophet does this under the heading of a great city. It's called the city of the exalted city, the high city, the waste city, a number of expressions which we'll note. Now, in these chapters, you have five contrasts set forth. First is the earth and Mount Zion. Here is the world, the earth, the realm of the unregenerate, as over against God's mount, or Mount Zion, where he dwells. Second, you have the peoples versus the people. Now, when you have the word the peoples plural, you're talking about the nation, the heathen peoples. When you talk about the people, with very few exceptions, you're talking about the Jews. Now, if you're talking about a nation and speaks of the people of that nation, it'll be singular. But ordinarily, when the singular is used, he is talking about God's people. Then you have the nations versus the nation. Now, the nations always refer to those heathen peoples. The nation refers to God's kingdom, to God's people. Then fourth, you have in the cities here, you have the world city, a lofty city, a waste city, broken down, a city of terrible nations, and the city of Jehovah. So there's a contrast you have in this. And finally, you have lords and the Lord, and death and life. Now, these lords are lords of the realm of death. That's bringing to death. The Lord is the Lord of life, brings us to life. Now, I think you'll find these four chapters very interesting chapters. And I know that you will if I can make them interesting as we go along. But remember now, you are not talking here simply about Judah nor Babylon. You're talking about the world and its judgment over against the people of God who will be redeemed. Now, those principles still stand. They're just as true today as then. The world city, that is the world set forth as a city, a waste city, is destined to destruction. All this world is going to come down in destruction. Over against that is God's city, which is going to... And you have here a judgment of God against all that's of the world and worldly. That's going to be brought to naught. So the lesson is as practical tonight, and it is applicable tonight, as it was when Isaiah spoke 2,500 years ago, something like that. Let's begin reading. Behold, Jehovah maketh the earth empty, and maketh it waste. Now that word could be translated land, but earth fits it better, for it's a judgment against the earth and the earth dwellers. Jehovah maketh the earth empty, and maketh it waste, and turneth it upside down, and scattereth abroad the inhabitants thereof. That is, your inhabitants of the earth. God's going to scatter them. So here then is the description of a great world judgment that was coming upon all the heathen people then and would continue throughout time. The principles will always stand. These will. Right? And it shall be as with the people, so with the priest. As with the servant, so with the master. And I know these are singular, because here you have what he's talking about here are the different strata of people. Now, first is religion. As with the people, so with the priest. That is, the religion will not sustain them in that day, the false religion that they've held to. So as the people, so with the priest, the fact that he is a priest, or high in his religious position, will not give him an advantage unless he's righteous in that. So it will be, now second, the social condition. So as with the servant, so with his master. Here's another, and here's the household. As with the maid, so with her mistress. And now here's business. As with the buyer, so with the seller. And here's a little more complicated business. As with the creditor, so with the debtor. As with the taker of interest, so with the giver of interest to him. Now here you have these five or six strata of society. The religious, the social, and the economic, the business, and all of that. So there'll be no advantage to one's high estate. The only advantage is going to be the righteous relation that one sustains to God. This is going, what are you going to point out? The other things will not be to an advantage when God's judgment comes upon any society. Now, he's not talking about anything at that particular day. You can't put these chapters in any particular time bracket or time socket, because he's dealing here with universal principles that are as sure as is the character of God. This is what he's dealing with. So he moves on from that now. When he said in verse 3, the earth shall be utterly emptied and utterly laid waste, for Jehovah hath spoken this word. Now, since the word is from Jehovah, and I know that verse 1, behold, Jehovah maketh these things. Now, here is the sureness of it, and utterly laid waste, for Jehovah hath spoken this. So that's just as sure to happen as is the character of God, or the being of God. And the same principle is true today. When worldliness, rebellion against God, when these things characterize a society, is destined for judgment. So he moves on now, and be laid waste. It's emptied. It's laid utterly emptied and utterly laid waste here. Now it's for God has spoken, Jehovah has spoken. Now the earth mourneth and fadeth away. The world languisheth and fadeth away. The lofty people of the earth do languish. Now that are the great, the mighty of earth. They're going to be brought down. So you notice here, the earth mourns and fades, the world languisheth, and the lofty people are brought low. Well, that has always happened. It happened back there to those great nations of Assyria and Babylon and Medo-Persia and the Jews and Elam and all the rest of them. When they became lofty, great and mighty, they were brought low. It happened since then with Charlemagne's empire or kingdom. Later on, the great British empire, that's crumbling, has been all of my life, during my age and generation. Kaiser Wilhelm tried to build one, it was brought to naught. So also Hitler. Any nation that leaves God out of his plan and purpose becomes lofty, mighty, high-minded. God's going to bring it down. It'll happen to the United States just as it has to all the rest of them. It's going to happen to Russia unless time comes to an end before these nations are brought down. Now look at verse 5. The earth also is polluted under the inhabitants thereof. Now here you see the earth, and here the inhabitants of the earth. The earth is polluted. That is, the whole society, the whole world is polluted because of what? Because of the inhabitants. Isn't it strange that anything man touches is always corrupted? You ever notice that? Well, I can study history. Study today. Here is a beautiful wilderness that God has given, or the beautiful land, or the beautiful earth. You let man come in and take over, and after a while he's completely polluted. He's drained the soil. He's polluted the water. He's polluted the air. He polluted the whole thing because of generally greed, a desire to make wealth. These, I think, are the basic things. But anyhow, the earth is polluted under the inhabitants thereof because they have transgressed the laws, violated the statutes, broken the everlasting covenant. Now, I want to look at that for a moment. I'm not going to take the time to go into all the passages I could deal with and would like to deal with on that. But I'm going to look at two or three. And that is that going back to Genesis, the 26th chapter, and verse 5. I want you to note that Abraham here kept the statutes and the laws and the commandments of God. Now, verse 5. He's going to show him that I see shall all the nations there be blessed, because that Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. Now, I raise the question, what were they? What were those laws and statutes and commandments that God, that Abraham kept? I don't know. I know some of them. I know he told him to get out of the land, and he did that. But when it comes to statutes and laws and commandments, I don't know what many of them were. And so my point is this. I am convinced from these passages I'm going to call attention to, that from the very beginning, God has put man under law. He called it here the everlasting covenant here. So there was a covenant that God made with man back then. We don't have an account of it. I don't know what it was. But man violated that. He failed to keep that and went into idolatry and became wicked, and God destroyed him here with a flood. Started over with Noah. And I'm sure that God had made or gave certain statutes and laws and commandments to Noah, or else Noah had them from an earlier existence. So man was under law. We come on down and we find that in Moses' day, we find that Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, while he offered sacrifices unto Jehovah, he kept some statutes and laws of Jehovah. What were they and when were they given? Jethro and Balaam are the last two men of the Old Covenant that you find who were worshiping God or serving Jehovah, except the Jews. And so here with Balaam, he said, Jehovah, I'm going to speak what Jehovah will allow me to. He had some knowledge of Jehovah, and he also recognized certain laws that he was under there. Well, that suggests that man was under a law here. Now look at Job, the 23rd chapter, and verse 13, I believe it is. Verse 12. Job 23 and verse 12. Right, now here we have Job keeping certain laws here. 23:12. I want to turn to the New Testament. A passage I've quoted many, many times. 23:12 here. I have not gone back from the commandment of his lips. I treasured up the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. Well, what were those laws? What was that word? I don't know. I don't know. In the New Testament, the passage I've quoted so many times, in Romans, the first chapter. Now, I know that this covenant, that not the covenant God made with the Jews, because only the Jews were under that. I know it's not the covenant he made through Christ, for that hadn't come as yet. So we're looking back to some law or system of law and some covenant that God had made with the world back there, either before Noah's time or with Noah and those that came after. Now, turn to Romans 1. This passage, you've heard me quote so many times, I almost hesitate sometimes to turn to it, but it's such an important one because it sets forth the principle that I'm talking about, beginning with verse 18 of Romans 1. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hinder the truth and unrighteousness. Now, look, because that which is known of God is manifest in them, for God manifested it unto them. Now, who's he talking about there? He's talking about the Gentiles here. He comes to the Jews a little bit later. Here he's talking about the Gentiles here, and he goes on, for the invisible things of him since the creation of the world are clearly seen, being perceived through the things that are made, even his everlasting power and divinity, that they may be without excuse. Now, because that knowing God, they glorified him not as God, neither gave thanks, but became vain in their reasonings, and their senseless heart was darkened. Now, knowing God, you have two thoughts here. That which is known of God is manifest in them, for God manifested it unto them. Right? Then second, that's the revelation. Then invisible hymns, things of him since the creation of the world are clearly seen, being perceived through the things that are made, that's creation. Now God has left himself with two witnesses from the very beginning. The witness of revelation. That which he revealed unto man. The laws that he gave to them, the statutes, the commandments, whatever they were. I don't know what they were back of the law of Moses. And then second, here was creation that declared the existence of a supreme being, an intelligent will that exercised power in the creation. Now he goes on to hear, knowing God, they glorified it not as God. Now verse 22, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God for the likeness of an image of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed beasts and creeping things. Wherefore God gave them up in the lust of their hearts unto uncleanness, that their body should be dishonored among themselves, for that they exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. What? Now, they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. You've heard me say this many times. You can't exchange something that you don't have for something else. I couldn't exchange a $100 bill here tonight for a $5,000 automobile because I don't have a $100 bill in my pocket. Now, give me time to go to the bank. I might make an arrangement for one, but I don't have one now. So my point, I can't exchange that which I don't have. Now, if they exchanged the truth of God for a lie, then they had truth that God had revealed and manifested to them, which they exchanged for the lie of idolatry. Now, notice he goes on here, and worshiped the creature, for this cause God gave them up unto vile passions. For the women changed the natural use into that which is against nature. Likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust one toward another, men with men working unseemliness and receiving in themselves that recompense of the error which was due. might not actually be there, but somewhere back then, they had some kind of a moral law that taught them that these were, and it's hard for me to believe, that man has written in his heart a moral law by which he knows what's wrong and knows what's right. Because God revealed that. If he already had that, then why reveal it? Reveal these matters to him. No, I don't think so. I think man has a spiritual nature, a capacity to be taught. Now, when you were born into this world, what did you know about right and wrong? As you grew up, where did you learn it? Didn't somebody teach you? Yeah, I learned right and wrong from my mother. And then later on, from Bible teachers. I learned right and wrong. What was right, what was wrong. I may have a revulsion against killing somebody, but how do I know that that is a sin against God? I wouldn't know it unless he revealed it, would I? I can't say how I could. I was born, my mind was a blank sheet of paper. Everything that I knew was written on that mind. I'm teaching since then. Now notice further. And even if they refused to have God in their knowledge, God gave them up to a reprobate mind to do those things which are not fitting. Now here God has revealed himself. Now they refused to have God in their knowledge. Now what I'm trying to show is this. That here when he says here, he's talking about the universal, the judgment of the world universally here, the earth also is polluted under the inhabitants thereof, because they have transgressed the laws, violated the statutes, broken the everlasting covenant. Now I don't believe that that's the Jewish covenant, because the Gentiles were not under it. Only the Jews. Now he's already talked about the judgment of Judah, and deals with that all the way through the book of Isaiah. So here he's dealing with the judgment against all the world and worldliness. Well, a lot of other passages, but these are enough to get my point across here. I'm convinced here that we make a mistake sometimes when we come to the New Testament of taking certain things out of the New Testament and applying them to the world. They're wrong, yes, but they're wrong because God's revealed the wrong of them all the way through. But I'm not under the New Covenant until I bring myself under that covenant. Until I bring myself under it, then I am not under it. Though there are certain things that God will reveal all the way through that were wrong. They've always been wrong. Because they're contrary to the nature and character of God and the will of God. But when it comes to the covenant, I'm only under the new covenant. When I bring myself under it, then I'm subject to everything that it teaches. Now therefore hath the curse devoured the earth, and they that dwell therein are found guilty. Now they're guilty because they have transgressed and forsaken the everlasting covenant. And notice further now, therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men left. In this judgment that God is going to bring, there's a few men left, and we're going to notice who they are in that after a while over here a little further. The new wine mourneth, the vine languisheth, all the merry hearted do sigh. Now, that is, these things on which man depends for his pleasure and enjoyment when they cease. Then notice here, he mourns and he does sigh. Right now, the things that make the world happy and rejoice, wine and dope and drinking and all of these things here, and there's pleasures. Now these are taken away. He ain't got nothing left. He has nothing left. Because that's where he finds his joy. The mirth of tablets ceaseth. The noise of them that rejoice endeth. The joy of the harp ceaseth. They shall not drink wine with a song. Strong drink shall be bitter to them that drink it. All right? Now that's because the condition is such that it doesn't give them the joy they once thought they had. In that, look back with me to the Psalm, Proverbs 20 and verse 1, I believe it is. I want to look at it here for just a moment. Maybe 21. 20 and verse 1. Wine is a mocker. Strong drink, a brawler. Whosoever erreth thereby is not wise. Right? Now look over at the 23rd chapter here, and verse about 29. Who hath woe? Who hath sorrow? Who hath contentions? Who hath complaining? Who hath wounds without cause? Who hath redness of eyes? Now here's the brawler, you see. They that tarry long at the wine. They that go to seek out mixed wine. Look not thou upon the wine when it is red, when it sparkleth in the cup, when it goeth down smoother. At the last it biteth like a serpent, and stingeth like an adder. Thine eyes shall behold strange things, and thy heart shall utter perverse things. Yea, thou shalt be as he that lieth down in the midst of the sea, that is the danger of drowning, or as he that lieth upon the top of a mast, as the being cast off into the sea, the danger. They have stricken me, shall thou say, and I was not hurt. They had beaten me, I felt it not. When shall I awake? I will seek it yet again. But now, all right, now here the wine drinker and all that. Now here, this fellow here, the new wine mourneth, the vine languisheth, all the merry hearted do sigh. The mirth of these musical instruments and of the harp and the wine that they drink, when that ends, why then their source of enjoyment is gone, when that's taken away. Or you reach a point after a while when you're satiated with that and you do not, you get no enjoyment out of it. The point is here that those things, when man leaves the law of God, the principles of God, the things that God has set forth and seeks to find his pleasure, his greatness, or whatever it is, in these things, and after a while he comes to them, he can no longer enjoy them, or when they're taken away, the source of his merriment is gone. Now, compare that with your television programs today. Every time, every scene, nearly, when you two people come together to tell a four-year drink, and they go into to a restaurant, here they call for drink. It's drinking, drinking, drinking. And then turn to another program, and here's your rock music, and all that sort of assorted thing. Now, the world seeks to find its enjoyment in these things, that after a while they'll fail, as they go older, they'll fail to bring the pleasure. And after a while, when calamity comes and judgment comes and they're taken away, what does the man of the world have left? He hasn't got anything, has he? He didn't have anything. All right? So this is what God's pointing out. It's a general judgment governed by principles from Jehovah. Now notice further here. And the drink should be bitter to them. They don't get the pleasure out of it anymore. They're alcoholics now. All that sad story about Miss Betty Ford that was on the television a while back. What that woman went through, having become an alcoholic. Well, she went through that. And wouldn't dare to take another drink today because of the bitterness of it. What it meant to them, and others the same way. And so look not upon it. If you want to avoid the end, don't have the beginning. That's what it pointed out in the Proverbs. Now, the waste city is broken down. Now, what city is that? Babylon? Jerusalem? No. No, it's the whole system of worldliness set forth as a waste city. A city of waste. A city of no virtues, no profit there. And he said, the waste city is broken down. Every house is shut up, that no man may come in. That is, when it's fallen and taken away, it's gone. That no man may come in. There is a crying in the streets because of the wine here. All joy is darkened. The mirth of the land is gone. All right, so there's when the wine, now wine's mentioned three times. Verse 7, the new wine mourneth. Verse 9, they shall not drink wine with a song. And down here now in this one, there's crying in the streets because of the wine. When the source of that which they trusted is taken away, or they reach the point that they're alcoholics and suffering under it, then you see, that which they thought they had found was empty and vain. But in the city is left desolation. Now that's your waste city up here. Your waste city of verse 10. In the city is left desolation. And the gate is smitten with destruction. Now that word waste occurs about 20 times in the Old Testament. Tohu is a word there. It means waste. Back in the beginning, the earth was waste and void. Same word. Now, that word occurs 11 times in Isaiah. 9 times in the rest of the Old Testament. Now, that shows Isaiah what he's dealing with here. He's dealing with a waste situation on the one hand, as over against the Zion of God and the city of God on the other. No, notice further. In the city is left desolation, and the gate is smitten with destruction. I need to destroy it, and nobody there to come out. And those on the outside, they don't want to go in, do they? Like the story used to tell about coming to an old man wanted him to make a contribution to put a fence around the cemetery. Oh, he said, I don't think they're giving him money to it. Well, why not? Well, it says them that's in it can't come out, and them that's on the outside don't want to go in. So I don't think we need a fence around it. He didn't miss it very far, did he? No. Maybe keep the cattle out, would be all. But now, that's what he said here. The gate's destroyed, and because they know it's waste inside, nobody there to come out. Those on the outside don't want to go into that kind of a thing when they see the judgment of it. I think it's a pretty wise statement there. In the city is desolation, and the gate is smitten with destruction. For thus shall it be in the midst of the earth among the peoples. Now, I know that's plural. As the shaking of an olive tree, as the gleanings when the vintage is done. Right, so here, when that shaking takes place, I already said back here, few men are left in verse 6. Now here he said, it says, the shaking of the olive tree, and just a few olive berries are left. Just a few grapes here and yonder after the dead is taken. And so just a very few left here. But now you see the peoples, the fact that it's that plural, shows here that he's talking about the world, the people of the world, the heathen, the nations of the world. These are the ones he's dealing with in this a universal judgment here. Now, there's just a few left, and I think that fits in back here with verse 6. Now these, now who are they? The gleanings, the few that are left. These shall lift up their voice. They shall shout for the majesty of Jehovah. They cry aloud from the sea. Now that suggests to me that these, verse 14, are the gleanings of the last part of verse 13, which are the few of verse 6. So here are a few left, and these see what has happened, and they then shout and turn to Jehovah. So the few that are left would be those that are spared. And that's the same as Jesus' teaching when he said, many are called, but few are chosen. Enter ye in by the narrow gates, broad is the gate, and wide is the, broad is the way, and wide the gate, leads to destruction. Many they that enter in thereby. Narrow is the gate, and straight in the way that leadeth unto life, and few are they that find it. So not only is this taught in Jesus' teaching, it is taught in the Old Testament, that in the shakings of the world and the judgments of God, there are very few that come out saved, victorious, belong to him. All right, now he moves on then. In the next thought, they shall shout for the majesty of Jehovah, they cry aloud from the sea. Wherefore, glorify ye Jehovah in the east, even the name of Jehovah, the God of Israel, in the isles of the sea, that's to the west, from east to west. From the uttermost part of the east have we heard songs, glory to the highest. But now, it seems here that the righteous are the ones that are spared here, but the rejoicing is a little premature, because you're still going to go through struggles after that. Now notice further here, as it goes on in this, but I said, I pine away. Woe is me. That word means leanness to me. I'm lean. It means here that it's a very lean situation here. Well, so I pine away. Woe is me. The treacherous have dealt treacherously. Yea, the treacherous have dealt very treacherously. You still have, even after judgment, beyond the judgments of God, and a few that are saved, you still have the wickedness and the treacherousness of the treacherous. There'll still be treacherous, there'll still be wickedness to be judged, but God will judge those also. So we'll never get away from that. When we go through a severe judgment, we think, well, surely people will learn. A few do, but most don't. And you still have it when it's over. Treacherous have dealt very treacherously. Fear in the pit and the snare are upon the old inhabitants of the earth, as your earth dwellers. The people of the earth, I notice he says here, that fear and the pit and the snare are upon the old inhabitants of the earth. That's, they always get your judgment here. And it shall come to pass that he who fleeth from the noise of the fear shall fall into the pit, and he that cometh up out of the midst of the pit shall be taken in the snare. For the windows on high are opened, and the foundations of the earth tremble. In other words, the judgment of God will still pursue these individuals that act treacherously and wickedly. Now, you go through a judgment. Here are a few that come out saved. But rejoicing is a little premature because here the wickedness still exists, and in their wickedness, but God still judges. So as he pursues them, they fall into the pit, they come up out of it, and judgment overtakes them again. In other words, there is no fleeing from the judgment of God. The wicked are always going to be faced with that. God, there will always be these judgments. I think this is the teaching of this great chapter. The thing we're trying to point out here. Now, the earth is utterly broken up. Broken. The earth is rent asunder. The earth is shaken violently. And that's the description of a great earthquake. Look at the 29th chapter and verse 6 here of this book here, 29 and 6. She shall be visited, talking about the multitude, the terrible ones. She shall be visited of Jehovah of hosts with thunder and with earthquake, with great noise and with whirlwind and tempest, and the flame of a devouring fire. The multitude of all the nations, that shall fight against Israel, and so on there. All right? And so, here is the great earthquake of God's judgment. That helps you to understand when the wrath of God is poured out. In the New Testament, take Revelation, the 8th chapter, in verses 3 to 5. Now here the prayers come up unto God, and an angel takes fire off the altar, casts it down upon the earth, and there followed thunders and voices and lightning and an earthquake. Those are judgments from God in answer to and response to the prayers of the saints, that God vindicate and avenge their cause there. All right? We move on now. And the earth is and shaken violently. The earth shall stagger like a drunken man, and shall sway to and fro like a hammer. And the transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it, and it shall fall and not rise again. In other words, over and over come the judgments of God. In those judgments, here this society falls. It never rises again. Another one may come up in its stead, but that one's gone. Where's Assyria? Where's Babylon? Where's Medo-Persia? Where's Alexander's empire? Where's the Roman empire? Where's the old Greek empire? That's Macedonia. Where's the old Jewish empire that they had built in the days of Solomon and all of that? One of the great ones of the world. Where's that? Where's the old Egyptian? And all that, they're gone. When they are judged and fall, they rise no more. As I told my Revelation today, talking about the rising up of these which God judges. Well, he moves on then, and that it shall fall and not rise again here. Talking about the pagan world here. There's no place for it to escape. The only place of escape is in the Lord. When they reject him and trust in their pleasures and their wine and their music and all that sort of thing, then when judgment comes, there's no place of escape. Only to face God. Now judgment. And it shall come to pass in that day, as I pointed out over and over, always observe that expression, in that day. That always refers to whatever is under discussion in the context. Now, sometimes it refers to the coming of the Messiah, if that's in the context. That's not in the context here. The context is one of judgment. So in that day, the day of this judgment, God's talking about here, that Jehovah will punish the host of the high ones on high, and the kings of the earth upon the earth. Now, who are these high ones here that he punishes or cast down? I think Ephesians 6, I may help us on that, where he said, our wrestling is not against flesh and blood, but against the principalities, against the powers, against the world rulers of this darkness, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places. Now, I believe that he's talking here, the host here, that is the unseen powers, the unseen forces. I think he's talking about that. So many passages I can call attention to, but let's just look at one. Now, this one here, when he talks here about the powers and the world rule of this darkness, again, it also mentioned these back in Ephesians 2 and verses 1 and 2, and you did make alive when you were dead through your trespasses and sins, when you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the powers of the air, and of the spirit that now worketh in the sons of disobedience. Now, I think you have in that the idea of the host, the spiritual forces. Now, turn with me to Revelation, the 12th chapter, I think. I talked on this not too long ago, it seems like I did, but it doesn't matter, we never get through. Now look at verse 7, 12 and 7, and there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels going forth, that's in 12:7, going forth to war against the dragon, and the dragon warred and his angels, and they prevailed not, neither was that place found any more in heaven. Now this means a spiritual realm. It's not talking about some carnal warfare that took place in heaven. He's talking here about that warfare that began in the Garden of Eden in Genesis 3:15, here when Adam and Eve yielded to the temptation of the devil there, and God said, I'll put enmity between thee and the woman, between thy seed and her seed. He shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. Now from that time, this spiritual conflict was going on, illustrated here as Michael and his angels warring with the dragon and his angels. It's a spiritual conflict. Now what's the result of it? And the great dragon was cast down, the old serpent. He was called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was cast down to the earth, and his angels were cast down with him. Now I heard a voice, great voice in heaven saying, now has come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ. When did the authority of Christ come? When he rose from the dead. He had now conquered Satan, and he was cast down, and his forces accused them before our God day and night, and they overcame him, that is the brethren did, because of the blood of the Lamb, and because of the word of their testimony, and they loved not their life even unto death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and ye that dwell in them. Woe for the earth and for the sea, for the devil is gone down unto you, having great wrath, knowing that he hath but a short time. Right? Now, to me, you've got here the high of earth, and the high of the spiritual realm in this. So, these are going to be cast down, the host. Now let me look and see if you can agree with that. Shall come to pass in that day, says that Jehovah will punish the host of the high, of the high ones on high, and the kings of the earth upon the earth. Right? Now the kings would be the highest ones on earth, wouldn't they? Then who would be the host on high? To me, that's the spiritual forces. So you have in that then, here the time will come when God will cast down Satan and his forces and the power they've exerted. That'll be through Christ. But at the same time, these kings likewise are going to be overcome. Now notice here in the 17th chapter here, of this book here, here we have in verse 13 and 14, of 12 rather, and the 10 horns that thou sawest are 10 kings. That's the full number there. No, not just, yeah, I couldn't count 10 particular kings of the Roman Empire, any other, who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. I showed you symbolic language. Now these have one mind, and they give their power and authority to the beast. That's the Roman Empire. Now these shall war against the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings. They also shall overcome that are with him, called and chosen and faithful. Now in the 19th chapter you have Christ going forth here to war against these forces, and here the beast and the false prophet, and the captain and so on, are cast in the lake of fire. So what you have here, the great on the spiritual realm, and the great in the physical, that is the kings, all of these are going to be judged and cast down. Now what's the point of this? That is that everything that exalts itself against God or leaves God out in its working and thinking is doomed to the judgment of God and destruction. Alright? Let's go back to our lesson. Alright? And they shall be gathered together as prisoners are gathered in the pit, and shall be shut up in the prison, and after many days they shall be visited. Then the moon shall be confounded and the sun ashamed, for Jehovah of hosts will reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, and before his elders shall be glory. I will be the elder of the old covenant, the elder of the new covenant. God's going to reign. Well, now let me go back to the second chapter and verse 22 to 4 here and get this. We want to try to do the best we can in getting what the prophet is talking about to apply to us today. Now, in the second chapter here, 2 to 4, and it shall come to pass in the latter days, and that's always the messianic period, that the mountain of Jehovah's house shall be exalted, established rather, on the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go and say, come ye, and let us go up to the mountain of Jehovah, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he, that is God, will teach us of his ways. We will walk in his paths, for out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of Jehovah from Jerusalem. And he, that is Jehovah, will judge between the nations, and will decide concerning many peoples, and they shall beat their sword into plowshare, and their spear into pruning hook. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. Right? Now that's this mountain of Jehovah, that's the kingdom here they're talking about right here. For Jehovah of hosts will reign in Mount Zion. The Mount Zion here is over against the world, against the realm of the earthly. And that mountain is the mountain of the second chapter. He reigns in that chapter, as there he judges between the peoples there. Right? And another passage you might look at is Micah, the 4th chapter, and verse 7. Here in Micah 4, verse 7, we have this statement here. Well, let me look at 6 and 7. In that day, saith Jehovah, will I assemble that which is lame, and I will gather that which is driven away, and that which I have afflicted. And I will make that which was lame a remnant, and that which was cast far off a strong nation, and Jehovah will reign over them in Mount Zion, from henceforth even forever. Now I think that's what he's talking about. He's talking about the messianic period. In fact, that God's going to bring down the satanic powers. He's going to bring down the kings of the pagan powers. They're all going to come to naught, and Jehovah will demonstrate his divine power as he reigns from Mount Zion.